Hey, guys. How's things? All right. Well, good. I'll pretend I heard you say, great. All right. Well, glad to hear it. Glad to pretend to hear that. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Radio Network. Today, Gareth Porter and Mitch Prothero will both be on to talk to us about the war. Which war? I'm sorry. I should be more specific. The war against the Islamic State. And it's one big war, but I guess we'll have a little bit more of a diplomatic and Syria focus with Gareth, and a little bit more of a on-the-ground in Iraq focus with Mitch there. But anyway, hope to learn a lot. And I realize that I've probably tweeted out before, today on the show, Gareth Porter, Mitch Prothero, many times. And I wonder whether people think, oh man, the same old show, or whether they think, hell yes, that's why I listen. Gareth Porter's going to be on again to tell me what's right and what ain't right. That's why I keep having him on. He's right about just about everything all the time, you got to admit. Anyway, so, I like Mitch too, man. He does a good job. So, Argentina, I almost forgot about that. All right, so, yeah, I got a lot to discuss with you on the show. Of course, you saw the headline in the Wall Street Journal about the license plate readers. I'm sure you already kind of knew a thing or two about that, but we're going to talk about that. And other police state news, as well as got to discuss Iran with you. And then, luckily, I have a bit of time. So maybe we can go over some Ukraine and Yemen news as well. It's possible. Let's put it that way. All right. I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. I'm not really an org, but some other guy has .com. What am I going to do about it? scotthorton.org. Horton, like, here's a who. I never can pronounce my own last name right. I know that because everyone always says, wait, what? Wharton? Norton? What? Horton. Thank you. It means dirt house in Old English. Fair enough. I'm cool with that. There you go. scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room while you're there. scotthorton.org/chat. Hey guys, how's things? Good to see everybody in there. Doing good, as far as I can tell. Also, the full show archives and the interview archives are all there at scotthorton.org, as well as a bunch of other stuff. In fact, while you're there, do us both a favor and patronize those sponsors in the right-hand margin there. I try to remember to do this at least once every couple of weeks here on the show, to give specific mention other than just the commercials that play. And I know I need to make new ones, but man, I have so little time. But anyway, I've got some great sponsors, and the fact of the matter is, without them, there'd be no show. So, first of all, there's Mike Swanson, former hedge fund manager turned anti-war author and investment advice giver. He's at WallStreetWindow.com. If you have some money and you're trying to figure out how to keep it safe, go to WallStreetWindow.com. Well, and how to make some. WallStreetWindow.com. What it is it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a window into his trades. He doesn't have some, separate funny account. He's got, all his main accounts right there. He tells you exactly what he's doing with his money and invites you to follow along. Obviously the thing to do is fall on paper for a while, go back, look at his record, see if you like it, and see whether it's worth taking his advice or at least listening close to it. WallStreetWindow.com. And he's also the author of the book, The War State, which is just great, man. It's a revisionist history of the very early years of the post-World War II national security state under Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, and their various, as I say in the commercial, the ways that they empowered it and the ways that they also fought to limit it and usually lost. And it's the rise of America's permanent war economy, permanent fourth branch, the Pentagon, and the rest of the executive branch, national security state agencies. And all of that's really great. And he's working right now on one about Vietnam that I know for a fact is based on some primary source material that no one has ever written about before. That's from the very highest levels of things. I hope I didn't give too much away and get him scooped or anything. But anyway, that's the great Mike Swanson. And then Phil Giraldi's group, the Council for the National Interest, they have an America First that is butt out of the Middle East, especially foreign policy. And that's what they push. And they held the Rethinking the American-Israeli Special Relationship Conference, which you can watch all 8 hours of it on YouTube if you'd like, including me making a fool out of myself. It's Council for the National Interest, Rethinking the U.S.-Israeli Special Relationship. A lot of great speeches. Too much to list. This was a year ago. But go back through that list and watch some of those speeches. You will learn a lot. It's really good. And then Council for the National Interest. And then, of course, there's the Future Freedom Foundation and Darren'sCoffee.com. They've been very generous, as well as Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. They're a really great sponsor. I'm very happy to have them on. I know that Swanson is recommending buying metals. Well, I'm recommending you use Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. to do so. Mike Swanson is not a middleman making sales. He's just selling his advice. You want to follow his advice, you go to rrbi.co, rrbi.co, and that's Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. And then, of course, the bumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. I invented them but sold them to Rick so I could be a radio host, and he's kept that thing going for more than a decade now, printing stickers and making money. Every time I show up there, blam, he's got these massive printers now. They make the old printers look like a joke, and the old printers were awesome. But now he's got these insane printers, and every time I walk in there, they're running at full speed. And he's kicking ass over there at thebumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. And then, of course, there's the audibletrial.com. If you want to sign up, get a free audiobook on the sign up there. Liberty.me, use promo code Scott, and you save a buck. They've reduced the price down to $5, but it's $4 if you use the promo code Scott. And I got a new piece I got to cut along those lines, too. My Heroes Think, if you want a little statue of Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, or Harry Brown, they're awesome little statues, and they're very affordable and awesome. I have the Harry Brown one, and it's awesome. And then there's LibertyClassroom.com, a real education hosted by Tom Woods and his favorite professors, teaching American history and politics and economics. And that's LibertyClassroom.com. And then Voices of Liberty, I should give them a special mention too, because they've been running some of the best ofs, and I think they're about to start running some more of the best ofs there at Voices of Liberty, which is the new Ron Paul gig, the expanded Ron Paul channel, basically. So I'm very honored to be a part of that. That's really cool. And then, of course, there's Go-Kart Galaxy, and Whole Food Multicomplete, which they both buy web ads on the website. Give a word to them. If you ride mini bikes or go-karts, check out gokartgalaxy.com. They got the best prices on the whole internet and all that. They'll hook you up. And Whole Food Multicomplete Vitamins, if you're into being healthy and that kind of thing, check them out. No gimmicks, no magical promised cures or anything like that. Just good vitamins run by a good business, run by a good guy over there at Whole Food Multicomplete. And then, of course, last and definitely not least is QR code Commodity Discs. That's at CommodityDiscs.com or Facebook.com/CommodityDiscs. And they're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code on the back. No face value, a QR code. So you scan it with your phone and it tells you the exact price that it's worth right now in real time. And it's the most awesome currency ever invented, I think. That's, and if you donate $100 to the show or more, you get one in the mail, which is nice. CommodityDiscs.com. We'll be right back with news. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And I think part of what makes this show possible is this disorder I have where I consider anything left unsaid to amount to a damn lie. There's the whole truth or there's some kind of manipulation. So I was thinking about how I mentioned to you yesterday, I'd stopped by my Facebook page for the first time in many months because I was on a laptop that had it saved in its home pages or whatever. And I looked on there and there were comments saying, God, you suck at interviewing people so bad. I want to shoot you or me or both of us in the head. And that might be a little bit exaggerated, but not really. And so yesterday I conceded the point that, yeah, no, you're right, but you just have to accept that the show sucks, but you like it anyway, because that's part of the charm of the show is that it sucks. Okay, thanks. But that's not really the right answer. The real right answer that I thought of later, the wisdom of the staircase and all that kind of thing, is that I'm kind of trying to be the middleman here. And what I don't want is to have people on and give the same interview that they're giving to everybody else where they have to explain everything. So what I'm trying to do is pack as much information as I can into the question, in a sense, to spare the audience from having to listen to what most of us know anyway, but that the guest doesn't necessarily know that we know, so that he can get on with the new thing that we're learning today. And we don't have to learn what we already know from last week and the week before and the week before and from the last 6 years. Now, sometimes tell us about the last 6 years is the question, but sometimes I just want to know, since we all know this, what about that? That doesn't mean I'm good at phrasing those kind of questions. Sometimes it takes a lot of explanation. But the truth is, the point behind it is, I assume that I can give that summary faster than the guest can. And if I have to wait for the guest to give the summary before he gets to the new stuff with every answer, then it's going to take even longer. We might not even get to the real heart of the matter, because sometimes I'm looking at the clock and going, man, I got three more questions, and how in the hell am I going to do this? And that's with me going as fast as I can. And so anyway, I'm not saying I'm good at it, but I'm saying that's the reasoning behind it. And then the other thing is, and you've probably noticed this, is it's also a great substitute for when I'm unprepared, right? Like when I interviewed the guy on the jury nullification thing. I hadn't done my homework on him, on what all their project was or anything. Kind of fell in my lap. I said, great topic. Let's try to talk to the guy. But so I'm not prepared. I don't really have any questions. Not like I write my questions down, but at least I would have some idea what really I wanted to ask him. But so instead, I just basically fill in the space with everything I know about it and try to get a reaction and see if maybe I can learn something from there in that way. But a lot of times that just means that, yeah, it's live radio, man. I'm in a hurry. And also, just, I suck at this. I'm not a radio guy. No one ever said to me my whole teenage life, like, wow, you've got a great voice for radio. That's not it. I insist on being somewhere where people can hear me complain about things, because I just can't stand to keep it to myself. That's why I do radio. And I know you guys love my sexy voice because it's awesome anyway, but that's just a side effect. You understand. So, I'm sorry that the form of the show sucks. I'm just trying to get to the point where I'm learning something new and you're coming along with me learning something new. So the one guy said, oh, you're just trying to impress us with how much you know. No, no, no. I'm trying to add something new to what I know in a limited amount of time. Okay. And that's why I just wasted half of this segment explaining that. Okay, good. All right, now Iran news. The Iranian foreign minister told you, just like we all knew anyway, if you pass new sanctions, you're going to kill the nuclear deal. And of course, let's not anyone be naive. The hawks in America, they want to kill the deal. And in fact, for the most part, that's what they say. Never mind any kind of real definition. Just, we don't want a bad deal. Netanyahu says this is a bad deal, and so we don't want it, declares certainly the Republican Party and a lot of the Dems, too. Although, with their latest PR stunt, they just pushed, I think, at least the Senate Dems into the president's camp pretty solidly on this. But the point of it is that what they would call a good deal is Iran giving up their entire civilian nuclear program, and anything short of that is not good enough. Well, you know what? That's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. The question they're negotiating is how severely can they degrade Iran's program or make them scale it back so that if they ever decided to go after nuclear weapons, it would take a sufficiently long enough period of time that they could try to stop it hell or high water before it was too late. The breakout capability, so-called. But the thing is, there's no real reason to believe that they ever wanted nuclear weapons in the first place. And Gareth Porter, he slam-dunked this thing over at foreignpolicy.com. He went to Iran and he interviewed these ministers all about it. And they told the story. And it, I mean, read the work, man. It's not hype. The Ayatollah Khomeini, the old, meaner one that actually did the revolution and was the scarier poster boy than the current Ayatollah, he said that this is illegal under the laws of God who created the universe. You can't have weapons of mass destruction, no chemicals and no nukes, forget it. And that doesn't mean that nobody in the Revolutionary Guard ever had a little project, but it means it was never the policy. It was never the policy of the Iranian government to seek nuclear weapons, and in fact, the exact opposite. And their leading politician invoking the will of God to put the stamp of, and I really mean it, on it. And there's no reason to believe they've ever changed that policy whatsoever, other than a bunch of hype. So it's a breakout deal to prevent them from even having the threshold capability, when the threshold capability is deterrent enough. And when, you know, maybe the Israelis would have a war against Iran to the last dead American, but the Americans don't want to invade and occupy Iran or even bomb the hell out of them from the sky. They can put up too much of a fight. So this is really coming down to a very much, reason with Obama, who happens to be on the side of it this time, and the Democrats in line with him, trying to just put this issue away and thereby put the threat of war with Iran away, at least severely curtail it. Remember in 2007, they tried to lie us into war based on Iranian intervention in Iraq for the same guys we were fighting for. Nice try, but it didn't hold because Admiral Fallon, the head of CENTCOM, said hell no. Thank goodness for that. But anyway, they could come up with another pretext, but putting the fake Iran nuclear controversy to bed would be a great way to limit the possibility of a war with Iran. And that's why all of Israel's partisans, including all of course, the neoconservatives and their movement and their think tanks and the Republican Party that they own lock, stock, and barrel, are trying to stop this because they would rather have a war. They would rather have regime change. And think about what it means if you're an American nationalist, never mind libertarianism and non-interventionist. But just think about where America's got a war with Al-Qaeda types, sort of. They just keep making it worse and whatever. But then Netanyahu and the neocons want to say, oh yeah, and Iran, even though the Iranian side are our enemies, mortal enemies. We're supposed to just conflate them all together for the interests of a foreign state. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network here from 12 to 2 Eastern, 11 to 1 Texas time. Again, coming up on the show, Gareth Porter and Mitch Prothero, both on the ISIS war. I guess here's what I'll say left about the Iran thing. That would be, go and listen to the Jim Loeb interview from last Friday if you didn't hear it. It was really good, talking all about this conflict over the Netanyahu speech, where you actually have the prime minister of a foreign state, for his own electoral purposes, in part, being invited to come to speak to a joint session of Congress, which would make him the first head of a foreign state to do so since Winston Churchill, who's the only one who has ever given three different addresses to Congress, for whatever that's worth. And it was the leader of the majority, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, that arranged it, but without consulting with the minority leader, Pelosi, or with the president, and for the express purpose of having Netanyahu come and ask the Congress to pledge their allegiance to him and to Israel's foreign policy, which says that any nuclear program in Iran is tantamount to them possessing nuclear weapons, a nuclear deterrent, and that that is unacceptable. And this is happening? This is crazy. Now listen, if we're talking about, I mean, really, I'm not a nationalist. If Obama was trying to push us into a war, and Netanyahu was coming at the invitation of the minority or the majority, I don't know how to speak to Congress, but whatever, to come and say, wait, stop, don't, come back, then, you know, that would be one thing. But here is, in front of everyone, in the most blatant kind of way, here's a president who's been negotiating for a year and a few months now, who has gotten Iran to accede to a nuclear deal where they have abolished, they have ended all enrichment up to 19.75%. They have limited the amount of, they're still working on how much they're going to limit the amount of lower enriched uranium. They're converting it all to fuel plates and rods for uses in their reactors. They're making changes to the Iraq reactor that'll make it only spit out very polluted, unusable plutonium. And they're making a deal to have the fuel rods manufactured in Russia so that they won't even have a stockpile of even 3.6% enriched uranium. I guess you could say, oh, breakout capability, by pointing at the amount of natural uranium still in the ground and say, oh, they're, in Frank Gaffney's imagination, they're only 2 weeks away from turning that into a nuclear weapon or what. But here you have this insane intervention on the part of one of the political parties on behalf of the leader of a foreign state to come and undermine this American policy of putting this controversy to bed. This is a de facto peace treaty. This is a de facto major step on ending the Cold War between the United States and Iran. And think about it. America's been hating Iran and refusing to talk to Iran and isolating Iran since the revolution. And yet, and especially during the Bush years, while George Bush and Dick Cheney fought an entire war for them, it was like the Clinton years never happened. And the Reagan and Bush administration had changed their mind and decided to back Iran in the Iran-Iraq war after all and helped Iran win it. That was what Bush Jr. and Dick Cheney did. They fought an entire war for Iran and their little pet sock puppets in the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and their militia, the Badr Corps. And they tortured their way into the total domination of Baghdad. It's last official count I heard, it was an 85% Shiite city now. It's a lot more than that, probably. And so I've heard. So here, while refusing to negotiate with them on their nuclear program, while it just grew and grew and grew, America's fighting a war for them. And then accusing Iran of undermining America's position there. Well, yeah, I mean, they wanted their sock puppets to kick us out as soon as we were done stealing Baghdad for them. That's obvious enough. It was obvious all along. Go back and listen to my interviews with Robert Dreyfus from 2005 and 6, where he's 2004 and 5, where he's explaining, yeah, the Iranians, they want strong federalism, meaning they want to break the country up into three and run off with Shiistan and let the Sunnis rot in the sun without any oil money, without any power. All they needed was for America, the Army and the Marine Corps, to take Baghdad for them, and then they'd be done with us. Anyway, during that whole situation, we're sitting here pretending their nuclear program is a problem and the reason we can't get along with them. Obama's trying to solve that. And you actually have very mainstream writers in very important newspapers and on TV really kind of freaking out about this. And Jim Loeb really does the best job of at Loeblog.com of going through and in that interview of going through and parsing whose position is what here. But it's a pretty big scandal. And as Loeb said, this risks really diminishing the power of the Israel lobby in the United States, because one of their main propaganda pieces is that, hey, they're nonpartisan. I mean, which I care. But anyway, that's supposedly one of their big deals. But in this case, they're really being made to choose between the Democratic Party and the President of the United States, or the Republican Party and the Prime Minister of Israel. And it's a very unfortunate position for them to be put in such a stark manner in opposition. But the thing is here, it's not about partisan politics. I'm a libertarian. I hate all these guys. I think Bush and Obama should both be in the supermax right next to each other. You all know that. And let Netanyahu rot in there with them. That's, of course, my position on all of these guys. But this isn't a matter of partisanship. This is just the most clear example in short time that you could just look right at it with a single glance and just see just how stark is the difference between America's interests and Israel's interests in our Middle East policy. Might begin to raise the question in the minds of a lot of people, well, what might our Israel policy, our Middle East policy be if we didn't have the Israeli influence? And think about that. Go back to the Clinton years. That was why he kept the bases in Saudi Arabia. That was why we couldn't have a rapprochement with Iran or Iraq. Because Israel's policy was they preferred America have a dual containment policy rather than any kind of offshore balancing. And so dual containment meant full-scale blockade forever against Iraq, waged from Saudi Arabia, from American bases in Saudi Arabia, and a refusal to talk with or negotiate with the Iranians on virtually anything. And a refusal to come to terms with the so-called Islamic Republic, even though it was 15 years after the damn revolution. Come on. And that was because that was what Israel wanted in great measure. And so it goes all along. But people are saying Netanyahu should call this off and he should fire Ron Dermer, the ambassador to America, for putting him in this situation, whatever. I say no. I say go ahead and give this speech. Let's go ahead and prove just what a mockery of American little r Republican form of government, temporary limited constitutional republic that we're operating under here. There's a cartoon in a major paper this morning that has Netanyahu building settlements on half of the Capitol building. Occupied territory, huh? Whoever said that before and got ostracized right out of power. What was he talking about? The first Gulf War and the role of the Israel lobby in getting us into that one back in 1991. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Mitch Prothero, reporting for McClatchy Newspapers from Irrible. in Kurdistan. Welcome back to the show, Mitch. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much for joining us on the show again. So lots of big news to talk about. First of all, is it really so that ISIS has completely withdrawn from Kobani and the Kurds and whatever their allies are victorious there?
Yeah, the siege in Kobani appears to be lifted at this stage. They Islamic State hasn't disappeared. They control a huge swath of territory surrounding Kobani, which is actually quite small. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it does look like that the combination of U.S. airstrikes and some tenacious fighting by the Kurds has kept the city from falling, and I'd expect that to hold for now.
Mm-hmm. And now, how severe of a public relations crisis is this for the Islamic State? Because it seems like their public relations is a big force multiplier or a divider, perhaps.
Well, they really went all in. That's what I find so kind of baffling about this. In terms of military tactics, since June, you know, when they took over Mosul, they've been pretty careful and you know, very effective, to be perfectly honest. Kobani was very strange. They didn't exactly need it. It would have allowed them to connect a huge swath of territory, but really it was just a small sort of outpost sitting along the Turkish border. They already had Turkish border crossings under their control around it. And I think that it was really a case of defiance when the U.S. started doing airstrikes. They wanted to show that these airstrikes weren't going to hurt them and that they could continue to do as they wanted. And through October, it did seem that way. But then over time, you know, if you're losing 10 armored vehicles a day, reinforcements are getting hit as they're coming up on the road, and the U.S. is perfectly happy where they've got, you know, all these jihadis in one location to keep bombing them. It turned out to really be, you know, important. And that's not to take away from the, you know, the hard fighting by a small group of Kurdish militia that were also backed by about 200 guys from Iraq that went to help them. So it just basically turned into a symbolic thing for both sides. So, yeah, it hurts them. It also hurts them because they lost a lot of men and a lot of equipment.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard. I mean, I don't know the whole history of warfare and whatever, but it seems on its face like it's pretty difficult for an insurgent group like al-Qaeda in Iraq to turn into a government, and especially one out of whole cloth, right? We're not talking about a coup in Baghdad against Saddam and they take it over, a government that already exists without de-bothifying it, right, but just conquering it or something. But creating one out of whole cloth, a bunch of school shooters, as you call them, good luck with that.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is they've been very effective militarily. I mean, this is a group that's undergone a bunch of transformations. They started off as a small cell of guys that would conduct operations, even what you'd call terror operations, suicide bombings, attacks on U.S. troops in 2003, 4, 5. Then they slowly morphed and grew allies to the point where they sort of tried to take over particularly Western Iraq and some central. That got smacked down by the Sunni tribes as part of what we, you know, the U.S. calls the surge. You know, but that was primarily an Iraqi reaction to that. So they went back underground. And Syria allowed them to come back as what they'd like to be seen as, a legitimate military fighting force that fights a combination of insurgency and conventional. The problem with being a conventional army is air power really does have an effect on conventional armies. It's really hard to hit, you know, six guerrillas setting up a mortar somewhere on a mountainside, but it's not that hard to hit a caravan of, you know, 40 or 50 pickup trucks in the desert.
Right. Yeah, they're just setting themselves up. And now, so your most recent piece here, or the one before your most recent about Kobani, was about the Japanese hostage. I guess the one has been killed, and they've changed their demands from give us, I forgot how much it was, $400 million or something?
$200 million.
And they changed that to they're trying to get, well, you can explain the change there. But the real question is, again, whether this is a symbol of Islamic State weakness here, that they're basically getting pretty desperate out there without much coming their way these days.
I wouldn't call this one desperate as much. Look, as people often forget, this is really al-Qaeda in Iraq. This is the group that was founded by Abu Musab Zarqawi. It's just 10 years later, and they're a different group that's in terms of how they've morphed. But a lot of the same leadership are those guys. Jordan has a handful of prisoners, including a woman, Asajia, who was an attempted suicide bomber in 2005 and is on death row. they want her back. And I can't tell whether it's a legit demand for her release in exchange for the the remaining Japanese freelance reporter Goto. But today there was another video where he says it's 24 hours or then they're going to kill me. And right before me, they're going to kill the Jordanian pilot. If you swap me for her, I'll live. If you don't do it in 24 hours, I'll die. And 24 hours is a pretty hard time to set up a deal. So I get mixed signals from them. When they asked for 200 million in 72 hours, I talked to experts, that's almost feasibly impossible, putting $200 million together, getting approval, and then finding a guy to deliver it to. Almost can't be done. So it was clear they wanted to kill at least one of the hostages to send a message. With this, I can't quite tell if they're just setting it up so that they can kill the Jordanian pilot and this poor, Japanese freelancer, or whether or not they, are genuinely trying to come up with a deal to get some of their prisoners back in exchange for people they have.
All right. Well, and you can see what I'm driving at with all this is I'm looking for an easy out, and I don't want America to help the Iranians beat these guys. I want to see the Sunni tribes decide that they would rather not take orders from Baghdadi and his guys anymore. And whatever role American air power can play in that, it seems to be only counterproductive so far, as far as driving new recruits, that kind of thing. But I wonder, about the relative power, how you score it, and what are the chances of another Sunni-type awakening, which, as you said, was really an Iraqi reaction, even though they give Petraeus the credit for it. It was a nationalist reaction to all these foreign jihadis coming, showing up and bossing them around, which how long should people be expected to put up with that, whether they're Americans or Libyans?
Well, what it comes down to a large extent is it's the complete lack of trust currently between the Sunni tribes, the Shia-led government, and the Kurdish guys. Iraq barely exists at this stage, and mentally, I'm not sure it exists at all in the minds of its own people. And that's a really hard thing to put back together. The American airstrikes have done a good job so far. I have to say, now that we've watched them over the course of months, they are hurting the Islamic State. They cannot move guys around like they'd like to. And particularly in the north, where there's a lot of wide open desert, they've managed to work very well with the Kurds to slowly choke off Mosul. Although going inside Mosul is going to be a heck of a military operation and very difficult. But if you look on a map, you can kind of tell what they're doing, which is they're isolating Tal Afar, Mosul from Syria, behind American airstrikes, and that seems to be going pretty well. The question is, does the Iraqi central government, the Shia, want to go up and fight and die in Mosul, a primarily Sunni city that hates them?
I take for granted that the answer to that is absolutely not. My question is about the Sunni tribes and how long. I already take it for granted, Mitch, since we've talked almost 2/3 of a year ago or whatever now, that Sunnistan has declared independence from George W. Bush's stan in the southeast there, and that's already over. So my question is about the tribes versus the Islamic State and who's the boss of who and for how long there. Because it seems like if the tribes can decide that, no, you're not the caliph, this is our land, and we rule this place, not you, then maybe that would be a reason that could be cited why America could start intervening less rather than more over there.
Well, I could see that being very possible. I talked to a lot of Sunni tribal guys. The problem is this version of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, is exponentially more powerful than the guys they got rid of back in 2007 and 8. This is a large conventional army. It's learned its lessons. It's got tons of equipment and money and spans two countries. So it's not a case of, 10 guys in tracksuits with rusty Kalashnikovs showing up and saying, all right, the bad guys are over there and the Americans go and kill them, which is basically what happened in 2007. There's no trust. So who's going to give them money? Who's going to give them weapons? Who's going to give them walkie-talkies to support their own operations and coordinate? And the biggest thing that I see is back in the time of the surge, one thing the Americans could do was, one, go kill the guys – very effectively, that their new Sunni allies were telling them were the bad guys. The other thing is the leaders could hide out on U.S. bases while they did that. Right now, if you're an anti-ISIS leader in Fallujah, you're going to get beheaded.
Right.
That's it.
All right. That's it. Thanks very much, Mitch. Good to talk to you again.
No problem at all. It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's Mitch Prothero. He's writing for McClatchyDC.com and McClatchy Newspapers out of Irbil, Kurdistan. And we'll be back. Gareth Porter next. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. What a mess, what a mess. All right, welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, go check out Bell True's Twitter feed for updates about the attack on the hotel in Tripoli right now. Sorry, I didn't have time to cover that. Oh, man, and go look at the Wall Street Journal. Put it in Google News, Wall Street Journal license plates, and they'll let you read the whole thing if you follow a Google News link. That's an end run around Wall Street Journal's paywall there. I've been warning you since I was a high school kid that they're taking pictures of your license plates and they're saving it all forever. And turns out, of course, that I was right all along. All right, now our next guest is our good friend Gareth Porter. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back. Thanks.
Very happy to have you here. First of all, it's been a few days, and I know this is a complicated story, and I won't ask you to give everybody the backstory of any kind of thing or anything, but you famously have debunked the Iran had Hezbollah blow up the Jewish community center in Buenos Aires in 1994 story. And all the current narrative is that the prosecutor who bravely told the truth that it was Hezbollah has been murdered and made to look like a suicide. And then the reporter who broke the story had to flee the country in terror. And so my question is, have you had cause to rethink your previous journalism in any way, or is there anything that you would like to tell us about the story that you have learned or added context or any kind of thing?
Well, that, of course, we could spend a lot of time on for sure. Let me just start out by saying that there is nothing that has happened with regard to Nisman's death changes one iota the story that I have great confidence that the story that I have written about lack of any evidence that Iran or Hezbollah were involved in the bombing of the Amiya Community Center in 1994, or for that matter, the Israeli embassy in 1992, that remains unaffected by any of this that has happened in the last couple of weeks with regard to Nisman. There are some things that I feel very confident about. There are a lot of things that I'm not confident about. That the things that I am very confident about include the fact that Nisman did not have any evidence whatsoever that Iran or Hezbollah were involved in that bombing attack. So the Nisman report is still what it was before, which is, that is, the 2006 request for the arrest of seven senior Iranian officials for that 1994 bombing. That report remains a highly politicized, shabby piece of work that should have been exposed at the time as what it was. It took a long time to become clear about this, that it was indeed a really hack job. So the short answer is that my view of that has not changed a bit. I think what we're looking at in regard to the events in Buenos Aires more recently the reality that in Argentina's government politics, you have no real confidence in the justice system or in the security apparatus of that country or in the government, and therefore anything is possible. Nothing can be ruled out. at this point in terms of who is responsible. I certainly don't know. I don't know if we'll ever know. And there are obviously different theories that have been put forward about his death, including, of course, that the government itself at high levels was behind it, that rogue operators in the intelligence service were behind it. There's also a theory which I think we have to take seriously and watch, that a former senior high-ranking intelligence official named Jaime Stuyuso, who was fired a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, roughly, you know, who had obviously plenty of motive to blacken the present government's name, certainly has the capability to arrange something like this. So I just want to emphasize that we don't know what happened. It's going to be difficult to put it together, if not impossible, and that this has a lot to do with the essential nature of this Argentine system, from basically going back many, many years to the dictatorship.
Okay, right on. And I'm sorry to waste so much of the time of a Syria interview on this subject, but
it's okay. It's very important, I think. I'm glad.
Sure. And I wasn't sure whether you'd have a different answer than the last time we spoke, which admittedly was just a few days ago, but it's a developing story, so, you know. But anyway, so check this out. You wrote an article for Middle East Eye. We ran it at antiwar.com as well. Can Obama untangle from Syria's civil war? And to go along with this, a couple of footnotes here. A major New York Times piece by Ann Bernard, U.S. Signals Shift on How to End Syrian Civil War. That came after your piece, I believe.
Right.
And then the news is that Kerry says he supports Syrian peace talks in Russia. Those are talks toward the having of talks, maybe, which is apparently, I guess that means they're scrapping Geneva II and its parameters, and they're going to start again. And then one more headline before I set you loose here would be Obama cuts off Syrian rebels cash, which is Jamie Detmer at the Daily Beast today, that, you know, finally Obama has decided to go ahead and switch back to Assad, George Bush's old policy of paying Assad to fight the Mujahideen for us. What do you think?
Right. Yeah, I think you're correct in suggesting that there are indications here that the Obama policy towards Syria, which was always highly ambivalent, to say the least, about supporting, providing arms to, quote, moderate rebels and so forth, is now essentially, you know, it's finished. I think there's another story that you didn't mention in the Wall Street Journal that recounts the pretty much complete failure of the limited arming of the so-called moderates, and points out, among other things, that some of those individual commanders who were lining up for arms really wanted to fight al-Nusra. I'm sorry, excuse me.
No problem.
Okay, I turned it off. Sorry, I didn't realize it was going to go off. Some of the commanders who were hoping to get arms from the United States wanted to use them to fight al-Nusra, not the Assad government, to make al-Nusra the priority. And according to the Wall Street Journal article today, the CIA folks who were in charge of this said no, they wouldn't support that. They wouldn't support people to fight al-Nusra, which is a rather interesting, although not terribly surprising, sidelight about that program. But it is apparently now recognized as a failure by just about everybody. Everybody agrees on that, and that's one of the several indicators that that the Obama administration is going through a very serious reappraisal of its Syria policy and trying to come up with something that is a bit more realistic. And among the things that is included in that reappraisal and an effort to try to reorient the policy is this idea of supporting local ceasefires, which I wrote about.
All right, well, we'll have to pick that up on the other side of this break. And I'm going to hunt down that Wall Street Journal article that I guess I missed.
Adam Entis is me.
And here's one more I forgot to mention, Assad's interview in Foreign Affairs.
Right.
Which is worth taking a look at as well. We'll be right back, everybody, with Gareth Porter in just a sec.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I found it. It's linked in the Daily Beast article about Obama cutting off the funding there. I'm on the line with the great Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist from Interpress Service. He writes also for Truthout, some award-winning work there on the Afghan War, etc. And he's the author of Manufactured Crisis, the true story, the untold story behind the Iranian nuclear scare, which is the book on the subject. And right now, so we're talking about the mess of American Syria policy. And I think we've joked about this before because that's the only way really to discuss it, Gareth, is that it's been absolutely insane and almost, well, depending on your point of view, maybe call it lowercase t treasonous for the Americans to have been backing the Mujahideen against Assad for the past 3 years. It was always the Nusra Front with the leadership before ISIS split off from them and whatever so-called moderate groups. We're always very marginal in this thing. They always have been. And yet that's what Israel wants and what Saudi wants and what Turkey wants and whatever. So now the ship of the American empire is so huge that it takes, you know, 9 months or something, 8-9 months to turn the thing around, to go back to war against the Mujahideen because the Islamic State thing got so far out of control in eastern Syria that now, come on, you got to go back to backing the Baathists. Obviously, non-intervention isn't an option here for these people. So they switch back to the equally evil and also counterproductive, but not outright treasonous policy that they had been the track before. And they're switching back to Assad, but it's taken them a while. It seems like. And that's what all this stuff is about, you know, trying to figure out which rebels to back or how much to pretend they're training up this army of 5,000 men who are going to take on all comers or, you know, whatever kind of thing they're pushing. But then, as you say, at the same time, behind the scenes, they're pushing for some kind of or actually for small ceasefires and hopefully toward larger ones. Right.
Well, this is let me just make one basic point about the arming of the so-called moderates that Obama finally agreed to. I mean, it's very clear, and this has been, I think it's actually in the Wall Street Journal piece, or maybe it's the Daily Beast piece, I can't remember which one, that, you know, he agreed to go along with that reluctantly, only under pressure from the regional allies. I mean, I think this policy that we are now seeing sort of peter out and you know, an effort to come up with something different is really an artifact of this a reflection of the degree to which the United States national security state is really tied up with these regional states, particularly Saudi Arabia and Israel, of course, the two big ones. But, you know, I mean, to some extent, there's the relationship with Turkey is involved in this as well. And, you know, maybe UAE as a security partner in terms of bases, in terms of sales, military sales to UAE and so forth. All these things add up to an enormous degree of influence over U.S. policy in Syria. And I think that is, you know, the hang up here. That's what is the problem that the Obama administration now has trying to move to something that is rational, which is, you know, to somehow have an understanding that we are going to, in some indirect fashion or direct fashion, work with the Assad regime to stabilize things and not try to, you know, really work directly against our interests of continuing destabilization in that part of the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the policy in Iraq is to, you know, to back Iran's guys. In Syria, it's Assad. There, it's Abadi and the government in Baghdad that George Bush put in power there. So at least it would be consistent.
Right. But of course, the difference there, as you know well, is that in Iraq, you have a regime that, you know, the Saudis don't like, but particularly, but they have not been committed to overthrowing at this point, you know, in the same way that they have in Syria. So it's, you know, it's slightly less pressure on the, somewhat less pressure on the United States, to follow a policy that is, you know, directly against U.S. interests.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, I'm sorry, please tell us about the ceasefires and all that.
Yeah, I mean, the point here is that the article that I wrote, I guess now two and a half weeks ago, was taking off from the very interesting information that came out in November, and then early December, that the Obama administration had been talking with and reading the author of a very interesting paper that was calling for U.S. support of local ceasefires between the Assad regime and the rebel forces, some rebel forces in places like Homs and particularly in the Damascus region, in the area around the capital. Now we know that dozens of these local ceasefires have in fact been negotiated, obviously with varying degrees of success in actually stopping the fighting, but that they have been effective in some cases, and Homs is one example that is extremely significant in terms of pointing towards a way in which there can be at least some minimum of sort of slowing down the violence in Syria and allowing the civilian population in these places, which have been suffering tremendously from the war, to at least begin to recover some degree of normalcy. And so there were signs that the Obama administration was interested in this. After the NSC director for the Middle East, Robert Malley, had met with Nir Rosen, who was a very talented, very serious veteran Middle East correspondent, a Middle East journalist who's covered all of the wars in the Middle East. He met with him sometime in November. And after that, we know that the White House held the series of meetings, one of which was presided over by Obama himself, which were discussing basically what to do about U.S. policy. And so there's reason to believe that there was a serious consideration being given to this. Nothing has been leaked since then, to my knowledge, since November, early December, about the Obama reconsideration of policy, including this point. But it seems pretty clear that is something that is now at least under discussion, if not actually, being undertaken by the Obama administration to give some kind of indirect support. The United Nations, by the way, is very, very much involved in that process. And one of the ways to do it is for the United States to work with the UN Special Envoy on that.
Hey, Gareth, can you do one more segment or you got to go? Go ahead.
I guess I could do another segment.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I'm sorry for the crappy ending there, man. My mic was off. I tried to say that on the air. I was going to put you on the spot live.
Yeah. Okay. So are we live now?
No.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, man. Well, there's an endless list of questions here, so I'll try to limit it. But
yeah. Go ahead, ask questions. I mean, that's the best thing to do. Is ask questions, make points. I can respond. I mean, instead of me just sort of rambling.
Oh no. Well, yeah, I'm not very good at asking questions, but there are things that I want to know, so I try to get around to those.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so I'm sorry about how crass and horrible these commercials are, but bear with me for just a minute, okay?
Yeah.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Hey, I got Garrett to stay on one more segment with us. Hooray. Talking about the situation in Syria and Iraq and the Islamic State and this and that. So like I was saying, Gareth, earlier, I find it kind of ironic that America's so bogged down in this policy of doing what Israel wants and fighting Assad because Assad backs Hezbollah and is friends with Iran and all their priorities, even where it ended up favoring. And I know that Obama was much more reluctant than Hillary and Petraeus and Panetta, as Hillary herself accuses Obama, yes, to make matters even worse. But he still has been, always insisting that Assad must go, must be a part of any talks with anybody and all this for all these years and help make it this way. But so now I've actually taken it as kind of an ironic relief that they're so bogged down in this treasonous policy that it's difficult for them to just outright back Assad, just like they back Abadi and the Iranians, and for that matter, join up with the Russians and kill these Islamic State guys, which is what I think they would like to do, since it's basically Osama bin Laden incarnate standing up there on a balcony like Mussolini declaring himself the dictator of, former Iraqi Sunni stand there, which is a gigantic PR disaster for the empire, probably incomparable to anything else. And so, but now I'm worried that they got the ship of state turnaround, and now they're going to start backing the Ba'athist army, and now they're going to have much more of a real war. They don't want to send in the 3rd Infantry Division, but maybe they'll, switch back to the Bush policy of really backing Assad against the Mujahideen, since the moderates always have been a fantasy, as the president says. And now I'm worried they'll get their act together and make matters that much worse, because even though it wouldn't be outright treasonous, it would be horribly counterproductive. I mean, that was what Michael Scheuer said, was for America to now come in outright as the air force of the Iranian Quds Force and Hezbollah and Shiite Alawite Ba'athist Assad against them is good for their movement. It just proves how right they are about all of their enemies in their own public relations. It's just as bad, even though in an indirect way. But so, do you think my fears are right that this could help pave the way to an even worse war?
I think you're right to be very anxious about that point, absolutely. There's always going to be an important element within the Pentagon that are ready to escalate a military involvement in a country, particularly when it's air power. And I think that's the situation that we see in Syria. So absolutely, if there were an understanding, an informal understanding, the United States was now going to tolerate the Assad regime and reach at the very least, an implicit deal that Assad would allow U.S. bombing, would agree to U.S. bombing, and that there would be coordination, tactical coordination, intelligence sharing, and so forth. There's no doubt that that would be very, very welcomed by very important parts of the Pentagon, particularly, of course, the Air Force, and that that would almost inevitably result in the kind of escalation that I think we all have to be afraid of, because of, you know, we know what the consequences of that are going to be. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, it's great what we're doing right now. I'm saying that it could get a lot worse, and that's something definitely to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was just speaking right before you with Mitch Prothero again, and we were talking about, again, the relative strength between the Islamic State in Iraq, as it exists in Iraq especially, as part of that discussion, now versus AQI back when, say, 2005 or 6 or whatever. And he's just saying, you know, it's magnitudes more powerful. Sure. And the ability to create any kind of awakening movement. And in Iraq, we've seen them do it, build up the so-called moderates, the tribal Sunnis against the bin Ladenites. And we've seen that work, but it took a lot of American intervention on their side to do it, as Prother was explaining. And so where Obama seems to rightly call it a fantasy in Syria, it seems to be their policy, I guess, in Iraq and Syria, right? Because I admit to you, even though it's the thing I'm worst afraid of, it doesn't seem like they want to send in the 3rd Infantry Division again like W. Bush did. That's the one lesson Obama has learned of what not to do. But what the hell they think they are going to do? Because, as Prothero says, the Shiites aren't going to fight for Mosul, Fallujah, and Tikrit. They're just not going to go and die for Mosul. And neither are the Kurdish Peshmerga either, and nor can they, really.
Well, it's a formula for endless war, isn't it? I mean, that's what is absolutely going to be the result of whatever the United States does or doesn't do. As long as, you know, it has a hand in the fight, we're going to have a war that cannot have any termination. I mean, there's nothing and no possibility in sight for defeating the Islamic State by military force. And so it is, as I say, a formula for endless war. And you know, that in itself is something that appeals to the national security state of the United States. That's what they're all about. Mm-hmm. So that is not a negative from their point of view. And you know, at the same time that they are, you know, taking advantage of this in all kinds of ways that, you know, you are familiar with, and I know your listeners are familiar with by now, they're also, you know, taking advantage of all their ties with the Saudis, the Israelis, UAE, Qatar, and so forth. You know, all of these extremely important relationships that the NSA, the CIA, the Pentagon, the military services have with the regional countries that have been pushing the United States, you know, in the direction of the most irrational kind of policy from a historical strategic point of view. Mm-hmm. Those are still very much a vital part of the calculus that goes into U.S. policy in both Syria and Iraq.
Right. You mean like Israel bombing Hezbollah and an Iranian general in Syria in an airstrike last week, for example. They haven't changed their policy just because Obama, just like Michael Oren said before he finished being ambassador, that, hey, we prefer these bad guys to those bad guys. In other words, we don't care who's the butcher of New York and who's not. We hate Iran more. And so, therefore, you do too.
No doubt about it. Yeah. And I just, what I'm trying to do here is to keep drawing people's attention to the sort of invisible links that exist between all of these major national security bureaucracies and the regional countries that are very much influencing the U.S. policy. They're both ties that have to do with programs, with formal programs that benefit the bureaucrats, and they're ties that are very, very profitable for the people who are either retired from these agencies like the NSA and the CIA, or who intend to be retired in the future. Mm-hmm. So,
and the corporations, too. I've heard it said, I forget who to give credit to, but that Israel is just a money laundering operation for Lockheed, is all they are. It's just American tax money bounces off Israel and goes back into their bank account all day long.
It's the Lockheeds of the world, but it's also the Booz Allens. And you know, that looms much more important now than it did a decade ago, obviously.
Yeah, like in The Shadow Factory by James Bamford.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for everyone. And that's in the Snowden documents, too. A bit of it is about the Israeli and American, you're referring to the NSA, the surveillance technology state there, right?
Surveillance programs, obviously, all kinds of programs that have to do with the NSA are involved, but also the contracts that are part of the whole approach to the Middle East that benefit all these players outside the NSA and the other bureaucracies.
All right, thanks very much, Gareth. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks very much, Scott. Good to talk to you.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Yeah, man, so I forgot that because of the time zone screw-up with Prothero there, that meant I had an extra segment of my own here today. Good. I mentioned Belle True in her Twitter feed earlier, writer for the Sunday Times, and there's an attack at a hotel in Tripoli, just more of the Civil War going on there. But then I wanted to point out this article that I've only read some of. And this guy, I like him okay. He's a little bit hit and miss, but yeah, pretty good for a mostly anti-war right-winger. His name is Michael Brendan Doherty. And his article is Hillary Clinton's Libya Disaster. Will Republican presidential hopefuls hold her accountable? Same question for the Syria policy as well. So it's a nice reminder that Hillary really helped lead on this. And, you know, I have to say, I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember not liking Michael Hastings' Rolling Stone piece very much because it sort of took for granted the legitimacy of any of this, I think. And I didn't interview him about it, and I remember going, this is not mean enough to these bastards at all. Are you kidding? For starting a war, you know? I don't know. But man, there's some gold in that thing. And I, you know, hey, all honor to his memory and everything. He was a friend of the show and he's a great guy. But that one report, you might read it and think, man, what is this? I don't know. But don't worry, because the facts in there are still very interesting. For example, Samantha Power, who's now the ambassador to the United Nations, you might remember that when it was Obama versus Hillary in the primaries, she sided with Obama and was quoted calling Hillary Clinton a monster. Oh, no. Well, guess who has higher rank than you? Hillary Clinton. And so after she didn't get the nomination to be the presidential candidate, she became the Secretary of State, which meant as part of the condition of that, Samantha Power, she can have a job, but she not in the State Department, and she was put on the National Security Council, in her words, quoted by Michael Hastings, doing do-gooder, rinky-dink stuff, like helping develop Iraqi democracy. Oh, yeah, what an unimportant project it is to, say, for example, try to convince the Shia to share a little of the oil wealth with the Sunni tribal leaders before they go all Al-Qaeda on us again, huh? Maybe some do-gooder, rinky-dink crap like that, maybe. Nope. Tired of that. She wanted action. She wanted adventure. Samantha Power wanted the president to pay attention to her. She was the deputy assistant secretary of nothing at the National Security Council. And so she went to Hillary and to Samantha and to Susan Rice and said, let's do Gaddafi, man. It'll be easy. It'll be great. And Hillary agreed, as I accused at the time, and Hastings' article only confirmed my bias and my assumption later on, that Hillary saw this as a public relations stunt because they were having a real bad time. Go back 4 years ago, just like the Adam Morrow interview yesterday. Remember in the aftermath of Egypt? It was so plainly obvious, even on American TV, there was just no way around the fact that America's good friend, the fascist military dictator of Egypt, who's been America's good friend for 30 years, who Hillary Clinton is quoted as calling a friend of the family, who she admires so very much, that he is a bad guy, that he is an evil fascist military dictator, and that when the people of Egypt had the chance, realized the chance, they all rose up as one by the tens of millions to oust his sorry ass from power, which by the transitive property of backing fascist military dictators meant that America was the bad guy. The bad guy. Come to think of it, even Americans begun to say to themselves, it seems like America is behind every king and every El Presidente and every fascist military dictator in the entire Middle East, from Morocco all the way to Pakistan, excluding, of course, Iran and Syria, but with Syria partway, because where Bashar al-Assad was never outright sock puppet of America necessarily, he was George H.W. Bush's ally in the war against Saddam in 1991, or that was his father, in 1991. And then Assad the Jr. tortured and murdered Mujahideen for Clinton and for George W. Bush. So he's still, yes, not, you know, a Mubarak-level sock puppet, but we had a operate, our government had a working relationship with him. So that really only 100% excludes Iran. Every other dictator in the region is an American sock puppet across the board. And this was becoming apparent to Americans. CNN could not take the side of Mubarak. When you look at the images, it's the people of Egypt, all of them, versus the military dictatorship here. And we believe in people power and democracy and stuff around here, don't we, everyone? How are you going to take that back? And so, finally, the government forsook Mubarak after it was way too late for him. They decided, and then they still tried to make his torturer in chief from Clinton and Bush Jr.'s rendition program, Omar Suleiman, the next pharaoh dictator in line, but that didn't work, and the Muslim Brotherhood won for a little while, and then they overthrew it and created another dictatorship under Sisi. But anyway, the point is that even Americans were beginning to understand Uncle Sam is a genocidal lunatic. He's the bad guy. America's government is the evil empire. And everywhere there's a fascist monster, he's got American tax dollars in his pocket. Every sultan, every king, every pretended president in the region. And so they decided they would overthrow Gaddafi as a PR stunt. To see if we can try to change the subject here and wage a counter-revolution in a way to make it look like a revolution, to hijack it, to turn it for our own use. And so Gaddafi, they had brought him back in from the cold in 2003, but that just meant he was in greater danger. As Henry Kissinger says, I think he probably repeats this as a regular aphorism, right, or a regular kind of figure of speech. I don't know if that's proper use of that term. To be America's enemy is dangerous. To be our friend is fatal. So welcome in from the cold, Gaddafi, and then they stab him in the back, and they back the Mujahideen. And go back and check the archives from this show and from Patrick Coburn's reporting and from David Enders and from Pepe Escobar and everybody writing about Libya back then that, hey, these guys are the Mujahideen. These guys are veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. George Bush just gave them a training ground for 8 years. Now they're home, back to Libya, and now we're fighting a war for them against Gaddafi? Pretending that this is just a carbon copy of what just happened in Egypt, and now, for PR purposes, we need to get out to protect the people there? And then nobody knows how many thousands of people have been killed in the raging jihadi civil war since. And it's all just tribal and jihadist factions killing each other. Two different pretended parliaments, two different governments. Apparently, America backs the government in, was it Tarbuk or Tarmuk or whatever? Not the one in Tripoli. And it's run by a CIA-backed general named Haftar. It's presumed that he is still, you know, on the American employ. Hey, at least now they're backing the secular general as opposed to the jihadist suicide bomber types for a change. Huh? Not that that's okay, but it's better than the opposite. And anyway, this is Hillary's policy, is to hijack the Arab Spring, to forsake and stab in the back our only kind of half-loyal sock puppet, Gaddafi, temporarily, you know, newly back into the fold, Gaddafi, and to try to hijack it and turn it for our own purposes in Syria, the government's own purposes in Syria. And then, of course, perfectly happy, the Americans and their Saudi partners are perfectly happy to help the minority kingdom dictatorship in Bahrain clamp down and murder and torture dissenters, mostly from the Shiite majority there, who weren't even trying to overthrow the king. All they wanted was a constitutional monarchy, where, of course, he still has total power, but there's some kind of law for rights of the accused and stuff, right? Nope. Violent crackdown. Then America did a coup and overthrew their own sock puppet and replaced him with his brother in Yemen. How'd that work out for you? Anyway, that's Doherty at the Week, Hillary Clinton's Libya disaster, Michael Brendan Doherty. And that's it for the show. See you tomorrow.